It's now my pleasure to introduce Professor Catherine Barnard, who probably does not need any introduction. Nevertheless, I shall faithfully discharge my duty. And Liso Aprin is a professor of law here at the faculty, specializing in EU and labor law. He's also the director of the Center for European Legal Studies and a senior fellow and deputy director of UK in a changing Europe, and many, many more wonderful things, but I shall leave it at that. And she will be speaking to us on the rule of law and the EU's single market. So thank you very much, and over to you, Kat.
Well, thank you very much. I just want to start by thanking Nabil for initiating this seminar. Nabil is doing quite remarkable things, and we're very fortunate to have him as a colleague here. Now, he's asked me to talk about the rule of law and the single market. And I'm very mindful of the overall theme of this seminar, which is about the potential unifying but also disunifying effect of the rule of law. And it's that latter dimension that I'm particularly interested in. So I want to think about the relationship between the rule of law and the single market. And I want to ask a question which is probably unpalatable for an audience of lawyers, which is it possible to have a functioning single market which is not fully underpinned by the rule of law? Now, what I'm going to argue is that the purest adherence to the need to comply with the rule of law may well have negative externalities. And I argue that in the context of what's happening in Poland at the moment under the Tusk government, who are really trying to get things back on track. But given what has gone before, this is proving very difficult. And I will explain all of this in a moment. And so essentially what I want to argue is that I think there needs to be some flexibility or margin of appreciation when thinking about how the rule of law might work in the context of an international agreement, which is the single market. And I would like to say that there's a decision handed down this week, which might actually provide some support for what I'm arguing. So essentially, my talk is structured as follows. I'm very briefly going to look at what's meant by the rule of law, or at least how does the EU understand the rule of law. Secondly, I'm going to ask why the rule of law is so significant for the operation of the single market. I'm then going to turn to look at the growing constitutionalization of the EU with the rule of law front and centre. And then to ask the question, is it possible to have a European market without elements of the rule of law? And then finally, as I've already indicated, a call for flexibility in, but not rejection of, the application of the rule of law in an international context. So to start with, I just want to briefly look at what's meant by the rule of law and what the EU thinks of the rule of law for itself. We know that the EU thinks of the rule of law as the cornerstone of the European Union. The Commission puts it under the rule of law. All public powers always act within the constraints set out by law, in accordance with the values of democracy and fundamental rights, and crucially, under the control of independent and impartial courts. And then in the rule of law framework document, the Commission identifies six elements to the rule of law, which to this audience will be familiar, and I don't want to dwell on it too much, but legality, legal certainty, the prohibition of arbitrary exercise of power, effective judicial protection by independent and impartial courts, the right to a fair trial, and equality before the law. And picking up on the points that Lord Justice Baker has talked about before the break, what I think you have in the EU is more at the formal rather than the substantive dimension of the rule of law. And indeed, like Lord Justice Baker, I had a look at the excellent paper by Lord Sales, writing about the rule of law and the thicker and thinner conceptions. But what is really helpful in what Lord Sales says, which is relevant to my argument about the single market and the role of the rule of law in the operation of a market, is he says that in the economic domain, a formal conception of the rule of law provides solutions to collective action problems, a response to the tragedy of the commons, and fosters the predictability and certainty necessary to incentivize economic investment. In the political domain, it's essential for the construction of political authority and then to give effect to democratic choices made by Parliament. In the moral domain, a formal conception of the rule of law respects the dignity of individuals and allows them to exercise agency under conditions of personal responsibility. Now, I imagine there's nobody in this room who would depart very much from those observations. And the very fact he has said it with traditional pithiness makes it a helpful jumping off point for what I want to say. So my starting point has been rule of law. It's important in the EU, recognise the rule of law framework. And of course, it's important in any democratic society. But why is the rule of law so significant in the EU single market? Lord Sales's observations were obviously more generic, but I want to focus on the rule of law and the EU single market. And I think there are six reasons why the rule of law is so important for the EU's single market rather than just democracy more generally. And I think the first reason is you've got uniform, it guarantees the uniform application of EU law, and that creates predictability for both EU citizens and for business. The corollary of that, and maybe it's just a subsection of what I've just said, is it means that consumers are confident to buy goods and services when they know that EU law is being applied effectively, both in terms of setting standards for those goods and services, but also ensuring the enforcement of those standards. And in fact, as Joseph Stiglitz put it very graphically, without rules and regulations enforced by government, there could and would be little trade. A world without any restraints would be a jungle in which only power mattered. It wouldn't be a market at all. Contracts agreeing to receive a good today in return for a payment later couldn't exist because there'd be no enforcement mechanism. A strong culture based on the rule of law maintains an investment-friendly environment, which brings me to the third point, that it does encourage investment, because if you know that the rules, there is going to be a level playing field and that the rules are applied and enforced, then clearly that points to a investment friendly environment. And indeed, Eurocommerce, which is a trade association, said recently that businesses can only function properly with a predictable and effective legal framework. In removing this cornerstone, the rule of law, on which the single market and institutions are built, countries would be undermining the very basis of the EU. So there are good reasons for the rule of law to underpin the operation of the market. I've given you three. There are three more. Important in the EU context is that it also helps to build trust between member states, and that leads to mutual trust, and from mutual trust comes mutual recognition, which is the premise for, of course, the Cassis de Dijon line of case law, but also the premise for mutual recognition of diplomas and the other areas in which mutual recognition applies. It also creates a level playing field between states. So states know that there is the same rules which will apply. And indeed, it's quite striking if you look at the one of the institutional protocols to, this is the new Swiss agreement with the EU, they actually identify the need for a level playing field to make sure that the internal market functions. And then finally, I would say the rule of law is valued. It's obviously a value. We've heard that from Nabil. And rather remarkably, it's even allegedly valued from those who come from systems where it's not respected. And a good example of that at the moment is the Euroclear litigation, where Russia is currently seeking judicial review of the EU's decision about freezing funds and the use of the funds which are currently held by Euroclear, arguing that the EU has got no competence to do what it's done. So the story I've told so far is a story about the rule of law being important, it being very important for the operation of the single market. I'm sure you can think of other reasons why it might be so significant for the operation of the single market. And indeed, not only is it so important for the single market, it's now become a core of the EU's constitution. And I think what we've seen in recent years is a rapid constitutional, a process of constitutionalization of the EU. Now, I'm not saying it's happened overnight, and some people might say, in fact, it's been going on for a very long period of time. You might date it back, Nabil, to 1973. I might say, well, let's have a look at Les Verts. In 1983-84, where you have the first reference in to a constitutional charter, but also crucially for what we're talking about today, a community based on the rule of law. You've got other stepping stones too in this process of constitutionalization. I don't want to take you through them all, but this audience will be very familiar with the decision in opinion 2 of 13 on the accession to the European Convention on Human Rights. And I think a real turning point in respect specifically of the rule of law is the Portuguese judge's case, where the court said for the first time that Article 2 is founded on values, including the rule of law. And that means, paragraph 31, the European Union is a union based on the rule of law, in which individual parties have the right to challenge before the courts the legality of any decision or other national measure relating to the application to them of an EU act. Now, in that case, the Portuguese judges were unsuccessful in their challenge about a pay cut as part of the austerity measures. But it was really the first time that the court starts to join up Article 2 of the TEU with Article 19, paragraph 1 on independence of the judiciary, and Article 47. And from there, that is a springboard into addressing some of the issues facing Poland. Now, my time is limited, so I don't want to go through all of the travails of the Polish judiciary, but in brief, the Law and Justice Party did a lot to try to interfere with the operation of an independent judiciary. In particular, it politicized the appointment of judges by giving Parliament control over the National Council of the Judiciary in respect of the appointment of judges. It also set up a disciplinary chamber of the Supreme Court to discipline judges. And that disciplining included over the content of their rulings and also if they had the temerity to refer a case to the Court of Justice. There was also removing judges using a reduced retirement age and then selectively reappointing them. And then judges were also appointed in disputed circumstances to the Constitutional Court. Now, as we know, this led to a very large number of cases brought by the Commission under Article 258 against Poland, and Lord Justice Baker has very kindly referred to a number of them. I just want to flag up one because I think it's a helpful summary, but there are many others. And I think you're familiar with the fact that in that case, you've got the court building on the approach of that we saw in the Portuguese judges' cases, that if states have signed up to the EU and when they joined under Article 49, they've got to respect the values in Article 2, and those values include rule of law, which takes you to an independent judiciary under Article 19 and Article 47 of the Charter. I'm not going to read my way through all of that, but the judgments are full of citable quotes about the value of the rule of law. If you look at the last bullet point, courts have got to be independent. It's inherent in the task of adjudication, which forms part of the essence of the right to effective judicial protection and the fundamental right to a fair trial, which is of cardinal importance as a guarantee that all rights which individuals derive from EU law will be protected and the values common to the member states set out in Article 2, in particular the value of the rule of law, will be safeguarded. So you've got strong condemnation of what the Law and Justice Party had done. The problem is, how do you fix it? Because there are thousands of judges who've now been appointed under that process. Those judges are referred to either as fake judges or neo-judges. And it's rather difficult to know how to sort it out, not least because now, of course, you've got a change of government led by Donald Tusk, who is committed to sorting it out. And in fact, they published in 2024 an action plan for restoring the rule of law. And as you can see, there are four pillars which broadly map onto the four issues I mentioned to you before about what was being done to undermine the rule of law in respect of the situation in Poland. But the really big issue that is currently being looked at is, what do you do with the judges who were appointed between 2018 and 2023? Because if you just sack them all, of course, that also interferes with the independence of the judiciary. It also means you don't actually have a functioning court system. And the court system, of course, as we've seen, it's integral to the operation of EU law. If I want to get my mortgage dispute sorted out, as you may know, there are thousands of cases about mortgages being taken out in Poland using a Swiss bank rate. And that was fine until Switzerland devalued its currency and therefore made the mortgage rates really expensive. And there are thousands, tens of thousands of challenges to those mortgage loans that have been taken out, which are being brought before the Polish courts. What on earth do you do about it? Now, the Venice Commission, set up as part of the Council of Europe, has been very active in having a look at how to sort out this problem. And they came up with some suggestions, which were confirmed at the start of this month as a rather sensible way forward. Now, I don't want to go too much into the detail because that's not my purpose this morning, but just for you to know that the Venice Commission suggested that you have three groups of judges: the green group, the yellow group, and the red group. And the green group are basically more or less okay, they can carry on. And essentially, those were novice judges who applied for judicial appointments in the deficient procedure as court assessors, court clerks, assistants to judges. In other words, pretty junior people. And they're basically fine, and their position will be confirmed in a draft law. There's a second group of about 1,100 judges who have been transferred or promoted in the deficient procedure, but they were appointed as judges before March 2018. So they were under the pre-Law and Justice group. And then you've got the red group, who are about 350 plus another 80 who are very much implicated. Now, the reason I want to draw this to your attention is because there are two things that's striking: that the Venice Commission have emphasised a margin of appreciation for the Polish system in sorting this out, because you cannot get this sorted out overnight. This will take time, and some people say it would take at least 10 years to get this sorted out, particularly if you went for a case-by-case approach, which is what some people had advocated. The Venice Commission actually says, given the gravity of the situation and given the need for getting this sorted out within a reasonable period of time, it is in fact legitimate to have this grouping of judges and work it through in that way rather than look at every single individual judge in turn. But what I just want to push, what I want to emphasize, is this emphasis on margin of appreciation, that there's got to be some flexibility. My words, not the Venice Commission words, but a purist approach that says you've got to have a pure application of the rule of law now is not actually functionally possible. And there's got to be some sort of trajectory to find a way of addressing these fundamental problems. Now, it looks like I'm advocating the absence of a rule of law, and it looks like I'm advocating some form of undermining of the rule of law. I would say in my defense, I'm talking about a more pragmatic approach, and pragmatism is important to try and address some of these issues. So my next question then is, can you actually have a functioning European market without elements of the rule of law? Now, if you think about it, the rule of law has not always been explicit. As you saw, perhaps the first mention of the rule of law was in Les Verts back in 1986, but it's only become front and center since the Portuguese judges case in 2016, 2017. Up until that time, there was not much discussion about the rule of law. And for those of us who've been teaching for a long time, we didn't spend lots of time talking about the rule of law. But it doesn't mean to say the rule of law wasn't there. And in fact, if you think about it, if the rule of law means about having an effective remedy, then think about the evolution of the case law and direct effect, the evolution of the case law and national remedies, cases like Factotum, Frankovic, San Giorgio, and so forth. Think also about the evolution of the case law under Article 263. Now, what I would suggest is what you're seeing is a degree of retrofitting. Cases that were about the rule of law weren't really described as rule of law cases, but in fact, that's essentially what they were. So rule of law has always been there, just never quite so front and center. I'd also like to say that it is striking in the EEA agreement itself, 1992, the EEA agreement gives Norway, Iceland, Liechtenstein full access to the EU single market. And there's no reference to the rule of law there either. Now, it might come in different forms, but there again, there's no reference to the rule of law. My point is that you don't need to be so in your face about the rule of law. The system does work without lots of flashing lights around rule of law. And indeed, if you think about the world of international trade, the big players, Sainsbury's, the Marks, Tesco's, Carrefour, and so forth, virtually never, ever appear in the law reports. Why? Because they're not actually enforcing rules. Because they can get the system to work. Now, of course, the system is ultimately underpinned by law and a set of rules, but essentially, they can find a way to function without rule of law being absolutely front and centre. So what I'm saying is I think there needs to be a bit more flexibility in, not rejection of, but flexibility in the application of the rule of law. This is particularly so when you're operating in an international context, where law and politics and the lines between them are somewhat blurred. And in fact, the EU and the ECHR does have a long track record of managing difference in the ECHR, the languages of margin of appreciation, and you saw that in the Venice Commission, but you also see the EU having a track record of tolerating difference, whether it might be through delayed implementation of directives, the very fact that directives are differently implemented in member states. And that tolerance can also be seen in the EEA agreement. Now, I've had to learn quite a lot about the EEA agreement for various reasons recently, and so I'm very grateful to Halvard, who's been visiting, who's helped me through it, and I may still have got this around my neck. But the point I want to make about the EEA agreement is that if you've got an EEA act, which is if you've got an EU act, which is considered EEA relevant, then that act has to be accepted by the so-called joint committee, which bridges the EU and the EEA pillars of the agreement. And the joint committee hasn't been always very speedy in adopting acts. There's about 600 EU acts which have still not been incorporated, or not been accepted by the joint committee, and thus haven't been incorporated into the EEA agreement, the amendments, the annexes, and thus haven't been implemented in Norway, Liechtenstein and Iceland. Now, if you look at the text of Article 102, it's pretty brutal. It says, you know, if it doesn't work, then in paragraph 5, the effective part of the agreement will be regarded as provisionally suspended. It's never happened. And it's never happened because it's seen as the nuclear option. So it's a good example of how the EU does tolerate difference, diversity, flexibility. And of those 600 acts, there's some quite important pieces of legislation that are included, including the GMO legislation, which is still not part of the EEA agreement. So there's flexibility there, and the EU does tolerate flexibility. And that brings me finally to my last point, which is the case decided this week. Now, I've only got the press release. I don't think the judgment, certainly when I was preparing this, the judgment hasn't been published in full. But it comes back to the concern about these neo-judges, these fake judges. Now, this is a classic single market problem. It was an individual suing another individual in the Polish court. And one of the parties said, well, we're not going to accept that judgment, because the judge who's just given the judgment is a fake judge who's been appointed under this process. And what's striking about the judgment, as far as I can tell from the press release, is that the court doesn't go down the hardcore route of saying, well, of course, it's a fake judge, neo-judge, and therefore, by definition, judgment can't be trusted. The court, maybe for the first time, may be showing a shift, says, okay, well, let's just look at this in the round. And instead of just condemning her, I think it was her, for being caught up in this saga created by Law and Justice, we should look at all of the circumstances in deciding whether that judgment should be allowed to stand. So to conclude, what I'm saying is the recognition of the rule of law in the EU is, of course, extremely valuable. It's important for the functioning of any market, but especially the EU single market, which is at the core of the EU's increasingly constitutional order. But I am suggesting there should be a wariness of such veneration of the rule of law in its purest form, that it becomes a straitjacket rather than a facilitator for the operation of the single market. That I think that some margin of appreciation is needed. I think we've got examples of margin of appreciation already being applied through the Venice Commission, through that most recent decision of the Court of Justice, and other areas too where the courts and the EU itself has allowed for some flexibility, not an absolute purist approach. And the reason why I'm suggesting that a certain amount of flexibility is needed is that if Poland is repeatedly condemned, particularly now when it is trying to put matters right in a very difficult environment, there is a risk that it could be so aggravating to the politicians and the public in Poland that they end up electing a government that will do a lot more harm to the rule of law. Thank you very much indeed.